This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and welcome to Night School, the show that walks you through fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, this show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and frameworks, the better to understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text or an idea we hope to shed light on the world around you. This week, Sharat, we're going to talk about dreams, mainly through Sigmund Freud's very famous theory of dreams.
We've talked about Freud before, haven't we?
Yes, yes. Various times we spoke about the unconscious, the Oedipus complex. But this time we're going back to an earlier phase of his career where he pretty much launched his notoriety and basically began establishing psychoanalysis as a field of inquiry.
Can I ask, I mean, when we think of Freud and, you know, how he opened up this whole new field of inquiry that people like Althusser say, you know, were really, you know, a paradigm shift in many ways. But what was he studying? I mean, what did he study and did what he studied or where he studied or under who he studied, did it have an effect on him breaking such radical ground in terms of knowledge production?
He was a neurobiologist, and I guess that's the equivalent discipline of that time, I guess in our terms. Basically, he took the standard training to become a doctor, but with a particular focus on the mind. Some biographical accounts said that he is quite torn about this. He felt more interested ultimately in the human sciences, humanities basically, and less so the natural sciences, but ultimately that's where he went. Back then, there was a lot of emphasis on sort of more physical aspect of what we would think of today as a psyche. So physiological features, biological considerations always took precedent than more metaphysical stuff or the more emotional things that we would associate our mind with. At that point, and even earlier in Freud's career, he was a practitioner of hypnosis. Hypnosis being a very popular, though contentious, method of getting to the heart of what's working in our minds. And he had worked around cases of hysteria. And basically hysteria in his context really means diseases which has manifest content appearing to be mental, but is not linked to any physical conditions.
And just the opposite as well, right? I mean, you imagine that you have physical conditions that do not arise from real dysfunction in terms of your organs or whatever,
correct,
but really arise from a psychological state. So you have welts on your body,
correct,
or you
correct
have a high temperature, and this has got nothing to do with an infection or
correct
anything. It really has to do with your mind.
Correct.
And I suppose that's the other kind of connection, isn't it?
Yeah, one contemporary analog would be phantom hands. So for amputees, they would not just feel as if they can still move their fingers when they're not there, but they can still feel itches. They can still feel certain pains associated with the hand, and this is largely to do with how the neurons in the brains have been so wired to be sensitive to that part of the body, even though the part of the body is not there. But at that time, Freud didn't have the technology, so hypnosis was seen as a way into this. But it was through the study of hypnosis that he realized that there was something else going with the mind, that it wasn't physiological, it wasn't biological in a purely physical way, but that the mind actually had a certain depth that the methods of his time, the prevalent methods of his time, couldn't really address. So this started him inquiring into what will be then called the unconscious.
I mean, I guess, you know, there's some basic distinctions have to be made between, say, brain and mind,
correct,
right? And what exactly is this thing, mind? Because with the phantom hand thing is interesting to the extent that it tells us that, in fact, our relationship to the world is constituted largely in our heads, right?
Mm-hmm.
Our eyes are not some sort of holes onto the world,
correct,
you know?
Correct.
It really is processed, and everything really exists there. Everything that we think is material,
yes,
and sensory is, in fact, the mind reconstituting,
correct,
those impulses, neural impulses.
Correct.
So that's the brain, right, in some sense. The mind, on the other hand, is this rather complex and odd thing. I mean,
correct,
I think there's something called philosophy of mind,
yes,
as well, right?
Yes.
Trying to kind of work this out.
The extent in which our mental phenomena is autonomous from sort of its physical limitations and stuff like that. And how consciousness came about. We are constituted out of the same chemical components that make other matter, but we somehow are conscious. So how did that come about? So those are the questions that philosophy of mind deals with. And it overlaps a lot with Freud's earliest concerns, you know. And at that time, too, we have to think about his very liberal setting, where there was a lot of optimism towards human rationality. There was a lot of optimism towards progress. The idea that rational self-mastery was the way to go because we are fundamentally rational creatures. But what Freud realized as he was looking at his patients and really probing into the nature of the mind was that the mind was far more than its rational capacity, and that this must be studied if we are to really grasp what the psyche is.
Yeah. So where do we start?
Okay. His analysis of dreams is interesting for many reasons. One thing we can start with is how this eventually tied his more clinical concerns towards a more general area of inquiry. You know, when he started out with his patients, this was seen to be a marginal concern within a specific discourse. But everybody dreams. An analysis on this activity that everybody does would, and it did in fact, make psychoanalysis more mainstream. His main, I guess, argument would be to say that dreams are actually wish fulfillments. Now, it's going to get a bit more complicated, but we can start with that. The idea that whatever it is that cannot be realized in the world, whatever it is that keeps us yearning, will manifest itself in our dreams.
But your dreams aren't necessarily nice things. I mean, you know, I mean, I have dreams that are utterly banal. Yeah. I wake up and I'm thinking, why in the world did I just waste all that dream time on that, you know,
yes,
to the extent I could actually remember it.
Yes.
And then the other thing, of course, is that you do have nightmares, which are, I mean, not a wish in that
Correct.
Sense, right, in that kind
Correct.
Of commonplace sense. So what is it that he meant by this wish?
Okay, so this goes to the next layer of what wishing is meant by in this case. He locates wish fulfilling as a particular outcome of the unconscious. And the unconscious here being the reservoir, very dynamic one, of unfulfilled and repressed desires. The convenient way of looking at this is to say that, you know, as human beings, we do not express a lot of what we wish. You know, never mind the fact that we don't get a lot of the things that we want to begin with. But fundamentally, as we go through life and we shape ourselves into particular individuals, a lot of these unfulfilled desires, unfulfilled impulses, these taboos that we have to put aside, will gather into constituting the unconscious that keeps getting more complicated and keeps widening and deepening as we have, you know, as we have to kind of make through life. So wish fulfillment comes from this source called the unconscious. And because it cannot manifest in real life, it will find escapes. And this escapes will take the form of dreams. This is the reason why sometimes dreams can be completely nonsensical, banal, or even nightmarish. Because the wish fulfillment comes out of an unconscious that's very dynamic, that's enmeshing all sorts of different desires, that it's not coherent. The chaotic form will find brief moments of respite in the dreams we have.
I mean, how did he tap into this? I mean, did he have access to people's internal... I mean, how did he make those assertions?
He did have access to his patients' dreams, which he analyzed. But this is an interesting paradox in the whole process, in that for Freud, there's no such thing as a dream itself. The dream itself doesn't quite exist. What we know of the dream happens during therapy, and it only happens in conversation with a professional therapist. So the interpretation of dreams is really possible only within the context of psychoanalytic expertise. Yeah.
So, okay, so this might contrast quite starkly with perhaps what preceded it, and I don't know how universal this is, but the interpretation of dreams as symbols of, as auguries of something mm-hmm. to come. You know, you have these really folkish notions that if you dream of a wedding, it actually is anticipating a death,
yes.
or you dream of a death and it's anticipating a wedding.
Correct.
Or there are symbols in dreams taken very at face value.
Yes.
Let's say if we only could break the code on the symbols, we would actually be able to tell the meaning, which again refers to something external to the person. It actually is about the world out there.
Yes.
So you're saying that in some sense, Freud puts that aside
Correct.
Completely.
Correct.
And the symbolic relationships in the dreams, one, you're saying
emerges from the unconscious.
Emerges from the unconscious and in the therapeutic session, right?
Correct.
So that you're not just tapping in some sort of unproblematic way into something that is there, into the, something in the head that is pristine, or it's like a film roll.
Yes,
like you just go into an archive and you pluck out this film. So last night you had Dream, you know, and then you have a little barcode under there. It actually is something quite different, right?
It is, it is. He even addresses that. So what were the prevalent attitudes towards dreams that people have considered, you know? So the first would be the earliest ancient one, the prophetic kind. And then he also considered, like you said, the symbolic take on dreams, which he said is kind of close to what he was going for. But he also emphasizes that, like you said, there's no dream in itself. There's no archive, like you said, that's just waiting to be interpreted. A lot of it happens in conversation. And there are a lot of issues in it as well, because he feels that once we really get to the heart of what a certain dream means, we would be defensive, because they would bring us to these repressed and blocked desires that we've ignored or tried to avoid for the longest time. So there are a lot of ego considerations that must go into a successful interpretive process, which he soberly recognized would make it very, very complicated.
Do you take dreams seriously? I mean, whatever the way you might interpret them, I mean, do you wake up in the morning and think about your own dreams? What?
I do. You know, therapy is expensive. So sometimes all you can do is just write, journal it down and reread it to oneself.
I'm told that the best way to record your dreams is to write it down the first thing you get up in the morning and write it down, because the longer you wait, you notice how quickly dreams and memories of dreams dissipate.
Yes.
They're like mist, and you can hardly grasp it. It's like an image that is kind of fast disappearing, almost beyond being able to articulate what it is.
Correct, and that's what Freud did. He would put a journal right next to his bed and write on it as soon as he wakes about his dreams, which we'll talk about more soon. But right now, we'll take a break after explaining sort of the general background of this study. You're listening to me, Ahmad Fahd Rahman, alongside Sharat Kutan as usual. And this is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is Ahmad Fahd Rahman, alongside me, Sharat Kutan. And you're listening to Night School. And we have been discussing Sigmund Freud's theory of dreams. And in the first part of the show, we talked about the general intellectual background of this study, why it's impactful, and how it differs from other approaches towards dreams. And this time, we're going to go a bit further into the theory to understand some of its components. What do you make of it so far, Sharat? Something you can relate to as a dreamer yourself?
Dreamer. See, that's the other notion of dreamer, right? It's sort of someone who lives in an ideal world or escaping from the harsh realities of the world into something more idealized. I'm not sure, because once, you know, you have all those provisos that this is really not the dream, this is the talk about the dream, and that obviously in the talk about the dream you're already adding stuff from your conscious mind. And I think, you know, the more we understand what, say, even things like memory again is, you know, not that archive from which you take stuff. Memory is actively produced in the present, though it has the fiction of the past, right? So you kind of, and I see that all around me in my, especially in dealings with you know, family members who constantly argue about the past. The past is this place of extreme contestation, right?
Yes.
So okay, so that's the past and memory.
Yeah.
And dreams are almost like that in some sense, except perhaps they're not shared. I mean, they're very personal to you, and so you have to, in some ways, have full ownership of it. I mean, you could be, you know, telling tall tales to your therapist, I guess.
Yes, and Freud made room for that. The idea that narrative plays an important role in us understanding the dream, because we would be projecting in that process. And that shows a lot more of ourselves and our relationship to these wish fulfillments, right? The interesting thing that you mentioned earlier, Sharat, is how universal the dreaming process is, in that it doesn't just refer to the dream we experience in sleep. but how it moves us to fantasize. It moves us to imagine things, that it really animates us to stretch our mental imageries. And in that, dreaming, while, you know, physiologically associated with sleep, is and it's an extension of a more long-standing activity that defines humans, you know.
I mean, you're right that, you know, we all often associate dreams with sleep.
Yeah.
But there's also dreaming that happens in ritual, and ritual that is induced through, say, the ingestion of some sort of hallucinogenic, right? So you think of peyote and the native North Americans and that mm-hmm. kind of, you know, dreamlike right. state that, you know, communities over eons have been able to put themselves in through these chemical driven technologies, and the Australian Aboriginal people as well, the idea of the dreaming. So dreams have a central place in a lot of cultural phenomena in human history.
And it seems to me that they all have in common this desire to push the boundaries of consciousness, of conscious thought, that sort of our sober, rational monologues does not reveal everything about us. In a lot of ways, that is what Freud recognizes, that when we dream, this is a different way of relating to ourselves, one that we have very little control over, which makes it all the more interesting.
So, okay, so we have Freud there. He has his therapeutic sessions with his patients. He uses a technique of having the patient talk about the dream. And you said the clinical therapeutic context is only one, and it was actually the launch pad for his more generalized theories about human consciousness or society and such, right?
Correct.
And so how much of this therapeutic and clinical work did he have to do before he felt he could theorize on this other level?
Because he felt that he was a scientist, he thought that whatever findings he could get from his approach could be read as a bigger statement about society. And you see indications of what's later to become the Oedipus complex also taking place in his analysis of dreams. The idea that dreams contain hidden thoughts, links to early experiences, or disguise conflictual wishes, certain compromises, all these things play out because we have been forced, really, to push aside a lot of our unconscious thoughts.
Do we have something from Freud that we could read that kind of demonstrates this kind of analysis?
Basically, this is where Freud summarizes the gist of his take on dreams. In the case of dreams, which are intelligible and have a meaning, we have found that they are undisguised wish fulfillments. That is, that in their case, the dream situation represents as fulfilled a wish which is known to consciousness, which is left over from daytime life, and which is deservedly of interest. Analysis has taught us something entirely analogous in the case of obscure and confused dreams. Once again, the dream situation represents a wish as fulfilled, a wish which invariably arises from dream thoughts, but one which is represented in an unrecognizable form and can only be explained when it has been traced back in analysis. The wish in such cases is either itself a repressed one and alien to consciousness, or it is intimately connected with repressed thoughts and is based upon them. Thus, the formula for such dreams is as follows. They are disguised fulfillments of repressed wishes. It is interesting through this connection to observe that the popular belief that dreams always foretell the future is confirmed. Actually, the future which the dream shows us is not the one which will occur, but the one which we should like to occur. The popular mind is behaving here as it usually does. What it wishes, it believes.
What it wishes, it believes.
Yes. So there also you find a connection, you know, when he mentions the popular mind, is the continuation of the impulse in our dreams and how it carries on to our everyday living. Because the wishes are a part of us, but cannot find a clear articulation in our day-to-day life. So yeah, the key thing about Freud's insight here is that the dream doesn't have to be fantastical or extraordinary. It could be banal, you know. It could be something as banal as meeting a friend, you know. But of course, when we say banal by standards of dreams, is that there must be some level of incredulity or some level of oddity, right? That separates the dream state from the waking state. For Freud, if the dream is so real that everything makes sense, then sleep basically ends. That there's no real gap then between waking and sleeping. Sleeping is a sanctuary for those unfulfilled wishes, even in their complex form, because they get to come out raw in that way. Yeah, where our defense mechanism are not armed. Yeah.
I mean, one thing, of course, is, you know, in popular films or just film, you know, the dream state is often taken up. So you have this music, this watery music,
yes.
And then you have the dream. And the dream has a kind of coherence that perhaps real dreams, or at least the retelling of the real dreams, doesn't have. You know, I find that a lot of the dreams I have are fragmented. I do know that I often find myself puzzled in my own dreams because in remembering them, that the person who looks like somebody isn't that person. Mm-hmm. Or I know that person to be X,
yes,
though they look like Y.
Correct.
You know, and
correct.
So my brain's saying, well, actually, that's Y, but it looks like X. Mm-hmm. And I can hold those two things together in my dreams. And there isn't a kind of nice cinematic storyline.
No, there isn't. Yeah.
So it's not, you know, Harry Potter, which I'm assuming is a dream as well for some teenage boy. But, you know.
Yeah, but even in the teenage boy's dream, Harry Potter wouldn't be really Harry Potter. It'll be some kind of melange of something else, you know. But so Freud gives us two concepts to help us identify what's going on. The first is condensation, the idea that because our unconscious is so rich with repressed thoughts, that in dreams they can inhabit one form. So you could have, I could be dreaming of X, but I could be thinking about Y and Z at the same time. Or, you know, the person might have X's face, but O's voice or something like that, because these wish fulfillments are so eager to come out, they come out in one form. So that would be condensation. That would be displacement, where a wish would be so terrifying that we would find a substitute, a less terrifying substitute for it. So, but all this is to say that there's this really rich and dynamic mix of thoughts and desires and unconscious. And Freud, to his credit, recognized that those combinations and the richness in there mean something, that they're not just these, like you said, symbols or just frivolous floating thoughts. We should keep in mind, too, what the therapy setting was like. So, like you said, there is always this puzzlement that we feel, especially as we're trying to recount our dreams, because they're so bizarre. And the puzzlement is interesting because it reflects a kind of instinctive reaction towards the things we're telling ourselves. And we need a certain degree of comfort to do that. And this is what the whole method of free association was meant to achieve. So typically, there will be a couch that's associated with the sort of the Freudian setting, and the patient would lie down on the couch, but the therapist would sit sort of slightly behind the patient, so the patient is not looking at the therapist, not projecting to the therapist, or not being so self-conscious. So the patient is looking up, and the idea is that the patient would be so free as to share, that there would be no defense mechanism, or defense mechanism would be lessened, and the narrative would then be the bridge for a closer inquiry into the unconscious. So comfort in sharing, a certain ease with the strangeness of the contents of which we're going to share, is very key in for us to get to the dream and what it means. Yeah.
So how long did this work continue? I mean, how long did he stay with dreams as a way of doing his work? And did he abandon at some point?
He didn't abandon dreams, but he did abandon a focus on it. Eventually, he's going to focus a lot on the psychosexual stages of a child's development, and that's going to help him crystallize the Oedipus complex a lot more. And then he's going to focus more on questions of civilization and culture, especially when he personally witnessed World War I, and he wanted to inquire deeper into the destructive side of human beings. So the death drive makes an appearance around that time. So, and he was always revising his theories. We should keep in mind that, you know, now with Woody Allen himself openly stating his debt to psychoanalysis, Alfred Hitchcock as well, it's become a part of popular culture, you know, and it doesn't unsettle us perhaps as much as it once did, when Freud released this, this was seen as very bizarre or offensive. One of the things that he's going to keep coming to is that at the bottom of all dreams, at the bottom of all unfulfilled wishes or the desire to fulfill certain wishes is sexuality. His claim is that we have these urges that we've had to really push aside in order for us to form ourselves as individuals in society. And that wish fulfillments, whatever it is that we make of it, is fundamentally, at the heart of it, anchored towards this sexual impulse, unfulfilled sexual impulse. And people are going to find that bizarre because it's so counterintuitive. And when he expresses this in scientific jargon to a scientific community, they all balked. And that led to a lot of strong hostility against his theory. So he was constantly revising it. In fact, Interpretation of Dreams was released in an abridged version, a much, much smaller and digestible version called On Dreams, where he restates his whole thesis in a very digestible form. In fact, a lot of his writings come in these booklet-sized books that makes it very accessible and is written in very lucid style.
Is it partly, this resistance to his ideas, a kind of squeamishness about the question of sex and sexuality and sexual identity and and desire, which is kind of slightly beyond the question of, sexual gratification.
Correct.
I mean, often these are things that collapse into each other, but I think they're actually quite distinct, right, in the way that these analysts talk about it. So is it kind of squeamishness? Is it hard to accept? I mean, we who live in a world where, the internet is driven partly by porn and then the other part by, serious news and analysis, right?
Yeah, which is largely destructive and violent too, when you think about it.
Are you talking about the news and analysis?
The news analysis.
Or the porn?
A bit of both, maybe, yeah. Freud, because he paid so much attention to the unconscious, and he thought that dream analysis was the royal road to a science of unconscious, he paid more attention to the smaller things in everyday life that we tend to brush aside. Dreams being one, but also Freudian slips, the jokes we tell, why we laugh. These things tap into a deeper side to us that we often ignore. So that's on one. That's just the first facet of the reaction against his work, because people find it trivializing that you're looking at these things that are really ultimately not, they don't seem earth-shattering, right? But then when he says, oh, okay, not only are we governed by our unconscious, but unconscious and sexual, then yeah, especially the middle classes of his time, they were appalled at the thought. They were appalled at the thought that, A, children are sexual, and boldly so, because they're less inhibited by social norms, and that we repress certain desires to our parents in the Oedipal form throughout our lives. This really rattled a lot of cages. So that added to the hostility against his discipline, but also his dogmatic guardedness towards what would constitute proper psychoanalysis. So he would expel even some of his disciples who felt, went against his orthodoxy. So it's a really fascinating history when you think about it. More so when you consider how much has been a part of popular culture today. So
I mean, I wonder also, especially in a very conservative society, the idea that a conservative society or an authoritarian state might discipline your body, might get you to conform in so many different ways, but that conformity will always be on the surface. Mm-hmm. That somehow, what cannot be touched by the state, what cannot be touched by religious leaders and all kinds of other forms of, kind of social fascistic dynamics, is that the inner core. I mean,
yes.
That, there's something that they cannot invade. Is it your dream life and your desires? And that, as much as they repress it, it will come back. It will return. Society might be terrified that they cannot engineer you completely and thoroughly, right?
Yeah, I think that's a really wonderful way of putting it, in the sense that there's something stubborn about desire. And we all realize it too. And that's why we are afraid of the desires of others, because we know just how dynamic and explosive it is,
And our own desires.
Yes, yes. That's even more frightening sometimes because we hear it directly,
And then in our heads.
Yes, in our heads. And they come through our dreams, So Freud recognized this, and while he would take this to conservative conclusions, he, you know, there would be instances where he talks about, you know, all he wants is a healthy ego, a healthy self, you know, and that healthy self must come to terms with these things. But other readers of his work will see this as an invitation to really confront desire and its full ramifications. Yeah.
Okay, so I guess we read those booklets, you know, Freud's own take on himself, which I imagine, you know, is directed at the kind of intelligent, ordinary person. They could read and understand it.
Yeah, On Dreams would be the booklet version. Interpretation of Dreams is thick. It's about, I don't know, I'm thinking right now, 400, 500 pages easily. So, and it's very systematic. But On Dreams is a much shorter version. I'm thinking, I don't know, 50 pages. And it's a very, very digestible.
Yeah. Right. And because there are all these beginners Freud books and stuff like that. What about books on Freud? I mean, biographers that you might recommend and such?
Peter Gay, who recently passed away, I think it was just last month, is known to be his the major Freud historian and Freud commentator. Critically, but at the same time, very open as well. So you'll get a very objective take that's ultimately favorable to Freud through his work. So you can just Google him, Peter Gay, and you'll see a bibliography, and he's a good place to start. Yeah.
Last question. Will reading Freud help us deal and manage with the world better?
It does to me. It helps. It's helped me a lot. But it also helps you understand what's at the heart of therapy, because there's a lot of stigma around seeing help, you know, around seeing psychologists or psychiatrists, therapists. The only true stigma is they're expensive. That one I can't deny. The whole idea that only weak people seek help, only weak people seek this sorts of discourse, is actually not true, because Freud shows that, like you said, the dynamism of our desire and the frailty in our ability to come to terms with it is something that everybody's struggling with. And being a part of therapy helps ameliorate that. And that can be helpful in you trying to figure out other aspects of your life too. So, yeah.
Okay. I have a piggy bank that I recently broke, which had, you know, the word therapy on it. And it was, the idea
what
was
that. What kind of piggy bank is that?
Yeah, you know, it was made by this wonderful person. And so I bought the therapy one. So when I emptied it, I had like 124 ringgit, which might buy me 40 minutes of a 1 hour session. Is that what it is?
I think so, yeah.
That's a going rate on therapy.
After some negotiating, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So I bring my piggy bank with me. Okay, yep. Well, thanks so much, Fuad, for...
That's fun, as always.
Yep. And yep. I guess we can ask you more questions via Facebook.
So, yeah, Facebook, BFM Night School. Just type that there. BFMNightSchool@gmail.com is the email address. Sharat, you can tweet him at Sharat Kutin. On Twitter. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and alongside me, as always, is Sharat Kutin. You've been listening to Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.